We'll talk more about that towards the end. So we wanted to get any feedback from Doug and Frank on that. And if anybody else has any questions based on what Ed briefed a little while ago, we can do that also. So I'll turn it over to Jordan now, and let's go down the action items.
Okay, thanks. Is everybody okay with me recording this? I don't know how well the recording will come out, but is there any problem with the audio recording? All right, hearing none, I'm going to proceed.
So do you need a mic for the audience or just for the
people? Well, that one wasn't working well.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. I want to ask a question here. It's probably okay with us for you to record it. The mess that you generated out of our previous 10 were very detailed. Did he transcribe those up audio, or did he use Frank's submitted question?
I'm unsure of the... There was no submitted... There are no submitted answers in the notes.
Okay, so everything in here was generated by you.
Yes, it was generated from notes taken during the call and an audio re-recording that I listened to a second time to fill in the details.
Okay, well, you did an excellent job. So if you're going to do that again, then we just want to know that, because Frank is going to send some in writing. But if you're going to catch it, that'd be great.
Okay. I mean, anything that's supplemental, we would like to have too. But we do go through the audio a second time to make sure that the notes are as detailed and as clear as was stated on the call. Now, I don't know. This is a different setting, so if the audio call for some reason doesn't turn out, then we're going to have a limited set of notes because it's going to be based on what I can write down.
Okay. Well, we'll see what you have, and then if there's anything that is additional to this meeting, then we'll send it.
Okay.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go through the action items that were prepared from the last meeting. The first one we're not going to discuss heavily. It was the one to work to collect and then distribute information on the Machitis area plugins developed by Raytheon NCEP Sport so that a unified decoder can be delivered operationally to support the experimental product ingest. All we wanted to state on this action item that this is a low-priority action item, but that Raytheon may be needed to deal with writing a VIS plugin for the FO perspective. We just got the VIS code for the NCEP decoder or the NCEP plugin in OB11.5. So I have not had a chance to look at that, and I don't think anybody else has either. Proceeding then to the second action item that we're looking for status updates on, it was Raytheon needs to further describe how legends are created and displayed, a little bit of information on the shader language and the process which images are interpolated is also important. For example, the maximum and minimum values that are displayed in the color bar are parameterized when the data selection occurs. And that's what we see on the screen as far as the color range. In the detailed notes, I think I hit some very more specific questions to this, but was there any further status from Raytheon on this action item?
No. Yeah, I don't think the software in this area has changed too much. So I think what's in the notes is probably about right.
Okay. I guess this will be as appropriate time as any to ask this question, but. Has Raytheon been aware of any requests from the Weather Service to design a NetCDF3 plugin for the software?
We've been discussing that just as we've been discussing it in terms of how to make it general purpose. You know, so you didn't have to write a separate NetCDF3 plugin for each NetCDF3 data type that you're going to deal with. But we haven't actually sat down and done it.
So is that something that's going to be done or no?
What was the question?
Is Raytheon been officially tasked with writing a NetCDF3 decoder for the software?
I guess so, Frank. Is
that right? I don't know what.
NetCDF3? No, I don't know about that.
No, I don't think officially we have, unless it's in a DR, captured as a DR, and that would be for a very specific, you know, purpose.
Right. So if you need one, I guess we need to get the DR going. Yeah, I'm talking about it.
Okay. Who can check the status of whether or not a DR has been generated for this? Okay. Ed raised his hand, so. We'll note that. I think the reason that had come up was that the OCONUS sites have experimental satellite imagery, I think specifically Guam and Alaska region, and they didn't have an intermediate format other than NetCDF3 to read that into the display.
I think our guys are wondering why, because we could read the Bacchides format with the INSTEP plugin, maybe, and eliminate a step.
Well, yeah, apparently, though, that there are some satellite products that don't go into a Bacchides area format. Alaska region doesn't have a site license for Bacchides. So, because that was one of the things I had suggested to Alaska Region was to look into the possibility of running their things through Bacchides, generating area files, and then producing them, ingesting them into AWIPS2 in that way. But apparently that's not a either cost-effective or time-effective solution for them.
Well, it might be paid to pay for the decoder.
Right. Well, I don't know what the exact costs are, but...
I mean, that's something that it might not fall upon, but it's no scheme of this. We need to talk to session today.
Yeah, I've looked up in our TRAP database about NetCDF, and I think that what it looks like we're on the hook for is more hydro-related. There's a small set of DRs that deal with reading in hydro-related data that's in NetCDF format.
Okay.
But I don't see anything in here with regard to satellite data.
Okay.
Okay, we'll take it up. I'll find that out here.
Can I add one thing to that? The main method for getting proving ground products into AWIPS is NetCDF, so everything is being created from various packages, IDL, a lot of combined packages, some from Bacchides, and so everything is already in NetCDF. What we're looking at now is having to go from NetCDF to Bacchides, and so that's just introducing another step into the process.
Are you still there?
Yeah. I'm sorry. We have somebody without a mic that's making a comment in the room. I'll repeat it.
And so
if
they're looking for a justification, that I think is in addition to the Weather Service requirements, that it would just streamline the pipe immensely not to have to go back and start putting this data into an additional format.
Okay, yeah. The comment for the people on the phone was that there's the Proving Ground partners that create products currently in NetCDF3 format, and that there's additional justification, I guess, from a Weather Service perspective for having a satellite NetCDF3 decoder because it would essentially lessen the workload and the transition time for the CIs. Did I summarize that correctly? Okay. So that was it. So Ed has the action to look into that. I don't see anybody from Alaska region here, but we can follow up with them later in this meeting. Oh.
The
entire process
is to create an
ERF
for what you need.
Okay. I have that noted.
In the pipeline.
We need to say logic. We don't want to advertise it to our process.
Okay. Okay.
I guess on your side, you create a TTR. So.
Yeah. Okay. Great. We've handled one lingering question that we've had. Okay. Question number three here was, tell us at what point in the ingest and display process is the conversion between the bit space and the value space performed? How do we know that the value returned is actually the correct value? And we actually then restated this question because some people felt it was not particularly clear to read. If they can show us what happens to the data as it goes through the manipulations, first from the edX ingest through the decoder into the data store, and from the data store through the unit's conversion to the display, that's what we are attempting to determine. When we are dealing with image manipulations, how do we know that the manipulations are correct? And there's a number of specific questions on this in my specific notes from about a week ago. Raythan, do you have anything to add to that?
On the ingest side, it should be stored in the HDF5 bit by bit for bit exactly the way it came in. There's no manipulation of the data other than entirely. And decimation for the different display levels. So the conversion happens at the cave level. And we're going to try to diagram that out. And I think some of the answers that are in the next set of questions is the, I guess I call them the DMED question. We'll get some detail on that.
Oh, the submitted questions. Okay.
And we're in the process of trying to document some of this in a little more detail, so it's easier to understand what happens to
things. Okay. You know, one of the questions I had was, for example, an image subtraction. My estimation of what is occurring is that if there's a subtraction between two satellite bands occurring, those two bands are getting read out of the data store in their bit format, converted to value space, for example, brightness, temperature, and then subtracted. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding. And I was looking for the answer that was here. Let me read this short little paragraph that was provided by the developer just today on this.
Okay.
It says the subtractions are performed bytewise, and then the units in the XML file are basically ignored for satellite, since satellite only has a few derived parameters. It does not take advantage of the full framework. And then the SAT resource, which is the display resource, has been changed so that the difference parameter is valued signed bytes instead of unsigned. So it basically comes down to that the raw bytes are subtracted and the difference is returned as a signed byte, and that's what's used for the color mapping and sampling. So it's kind of a reverse of what you said there.
Okay. So... okay, so how do we know that the value we get from subtracting in byte space ends up being correct then? Because
that's a good question. Maybe this is I don't know if this was ported from AWS 1 or if they just made this up. I guess I'd have to investigate that.
Because suppose we have two piecewise linear functions that operate over that bit space. The values that are output from doing a subtraction in the linear bit space may not match.
Yeah, this seems to me to be incorrect way to do this in my mind. surveillance one or whether that needs to be changed.
Okay, thank you. I know that I don't know if it's changed over time, but it seems to me there may be more than one way to do a subtraction, but I'll wait for your further responses on that. Anything else on this particular action item? Okay. The next one is actually performance, and on our status call last week, Ed said that they were looking at the performance and data latency on the ingest side for 11.4 and using it to guide Raytheon and other developers where the software needs to be improved. We're still, I guess, a little unsure where the strength of the software resides. Should we be doing data manipulations and conversions on the EDEX side, or should we be doing that in terms of the graphics card and trying to manipulate what we're sending to the graphics card? The memory leaks have kind of changed, and they've been patched or fixed as the software is developed, so we've kind of seen a moving target. But are we at a point yet where we know where's the ideal place for a lot of our image manipulations to occur? Should we be doing that?
Let me just philosophically talk about that. We've evolved over the life of the project a little bit into moving away from doing things on the EDEX side to doing it in CAVE and then actually from CAVE to the shader language. And that usually sees a huge performance boost, almost a couple of orders of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives then EDEX a more consistent performance base as the load increases. So you don't have people hitting it, doing all kinds of transformations, and then that creates an uncertain load on the EDEX cluster. So the load is basically transferred to their workstation for those things. And I'll give an example. This isn't with satellite data, but this has to do with radarable thinking, where you might have a dozen radars. And our previous approach was to mosaic that into CPU, and that was taking a couple minutes per frame, which is unacceptable. And then that was moved into the shader language, and now it becomes more or less instantaneous from the operator's point of view in making that kind of a change. And the shader language support has improved a lot, and we've made it so that you can add shader
I think that you can have different mosaic algorithms and such. The answer to your question is, as you move into the future, she should be moving away from the EDEX business, kind of contact license.
Yeah, that's the perfect, it's actually the perfect type of algorithm. Those kind of algorithms are usually perfect for graphics cards because of they're basically vector processors, with simultaneous execution channel, and that's just perfect for this kind of stuff. So anyway, that's our take on it.
Okay.
What you're looking for?
I think so. If there's more specific information on that, obviously you don't want to deliver a piece of software with any memory leaks, but it sounds like we shouldn't be, although at this point I think we are using the EDEX for things like subtractions. Is that for satellite subtractions?
Yeah, I thought you were asking force of device. You are
We are, yeah. Right. So, but ideally, if we're writing things that are doing image manipulations, we should be trying to write it in terms of a shader language instead of trying to have the EDEX manipulate these large objects in the data store.
Yeah,
Yep.
Maybe easier to experimentally play on the EDX side because of the micro-widgets cryptic, you know, what you could do without the baseline change. But for probably long-term operational use, it's better to use the graphics card.
Okay. Has there been any more information, moving on to the next action item, which is, I guess, a little bit along these same lines, but the JAI libraries and very large data sets, do we know what the limitations of those libraries are for display?
I don't think anything we've done so far here has hit the limitation. You know, obviously there should be some limitation to it, but with the data sets that we've been working with, we haven't experienced any limitation in the library.
Okay. But at the
and in the last go-around, we had one of our developers look into it a little bit. It's possible to do, if you had really large files, to do a layer of tiling, you know, before you hit the JAI code. So that would be kind of a workaround for the limitations of JAI.
Okay.
But so far, they've been able to deal with, like, loaded data sets, you know, as they are. So I guess once they get significantly bigger than that, then that
fiber,
the problem will come up.
Okay. And this is going, I believe I heard Greg from SPC is on the call.
Yeah.
Yeah, Greg had some questions over the AWIPS 2 dev list that went unanswered about when a specific product is called, you know, where in memory is it stored and how does the process of dragging across the screen work. You can see there's some element of tiling going on there, but how does that whole process work from the time it's loaded to the time that the projection is changed through panning, for example?
Yeah, that's a little complicated, but basically there's a what we call a data cube that's kind of in between things. In between EDX and the display software and Cave.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically caches retrievals from EDX and then holds on to them for a period of time. And so basically, the retrievals are tile sets. That cover, I think, a little bigger area than the display area on the screen, and the time intervals requested. And so then when you start padding, you get off the edge of you can pan a little bit without doing another retrieval, but then you pan up basically probably a tile or two width, and it's going to then make a new request. And this is easy to see. If you're on a kind of a low-end machine, and you turn on and pay the yellow tile line, so you can see where the tile boundaries are, and you can see that it's doing that, you know, just visually.
Okay.
But once they're retrieved, they're cached to that data cube for a period of time. So then if you pan back over an area you've already been, it's not going to do any retrieval.
Okay.
Is the data cube on the local workstation or on the server?
It's on the local workstation. It's each cave that has its own data cube.
So if you have two caves, there's two data cubes?
Yes. And it's basically, it was originally designed to handle the problems with gridded data derived, it created derived parameters, and so on. And it to increase the performance of it, but it's also used by satellite data.
Greg, I don't have your email in front of me. Was there anything else on that issue that you wanted to ask or were unsure about?
Let me try to pull it up.
What we're trying to do, we're going to try to diagram that as part of the software design document that we're creating. We're going to diagram that out in more detail. But basically, if you look at the code, look at the data cube, and then the data cube uses utility classes to go and get the data, you can kind of get a feel for how that works.
So I think Frank answered what part of the, one of the questions I had was, so like the satellite imagery is a JNI file, so basically it's loading only that part of the JNI file from EDEC. So CAVE goes, does CAVE go through EDEC?
Yeah.
Does CAVE go through the data cube to EDEC?
Yeah.
Or is it?
Yeah, so you're right, it goes from basically the data cube has a utility class that does the retrieval, and I believe that's multi-threaded, so essentially it's a CLIPS job that does the retrieval, and it talks to the request processor on EDEC, you know, which is a drift service kind of thing.
Yeah.
They actually retrieve the data, so it's over HTTP, but it's using a drift serialization.
So it doesn't load the entire JNI product, it's just loading what has to be rendered on the screen. And then another part of my question was, where does it store the data in memory? And perhaps like if it was heap space or just somewhere, you know.
Well, the data cube, I believe, takes heap. So you would basically just, you know, be targeted as Java heap space.
So is that where you're subjected to the JVM memory size footprint of the 32-bit OS?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me think about this for a second. We went through a phase where we were experimenting with external caches. There's an open source project that allows you to cache objects that may be referenced in your JVM outside of it in a special kind of a cache. And actually, for us, that was a performance drag on the system rather than a performance boost, like intuitively you'd think it would be, but we had taken that out. As we move to 64-bit, the JVM will have more heap space. And then there's even an evolution beyond 64-bit with advanced JVM managing memory better, better than the free JVM.
And that was like one of the last questions was, I've heard that the 64-bit cave has better performance, and what was the status of, do you know what the status is of the Weather Service switching to a 64-bit cave?
Oh, maybe Ed or somebody from the National Weather Service could answer that more accurately than I can. I think basically what we've done is it'll run on a 64-bit OS, but we haven't made all the changes internally to accommodate, you know, rebuilding the software at 64-bit yet. And because that would require changing out the library and stuff like that.
So to answer your question, it's on our SREC list as far as infrastructure improvements. On my list this morning, too. So that's one of the things we'll be doing early on. But we haven't tasked Raytheon to do that yet.
I don't think there's any real technical hurdles with it. It'll require, picking up the right libraries, rebuilding, testing, and making sure nothing's broke. But there's a company, I don't know, just to add a comment to this whole discussion. There's a company called, I think it's called Azure, A-Z-U-R-E, which builds very advanced JVMs for highly scalable enterprises that can go to much higher levels of memory usage, and they have advanced garbage collection. So there's a point where, and I don't know if that technology will ever flow down to the free JVMs, but that is a path for very, very large machines.
Okay. Okay. Also, kind of along these lines, there was an action item for sport to look at the 250-meter resolution data. Of course, they've had some problems with the power outages due to the severe weather they had about 2 weeks ago. Has sport made any progress on looking at 250 very large spatial resolution data sets?
This is Matt Smith. When we get totally back online and get the plug-in, InSteps Machias plug-in, we will definitely give that a try, but we have not yet. So speaking of that, Jordan, do you know if anybody else has been able to successfully test out the InSteps Machias plug-in?
Speaking from Sims, we haven't because we didn't have the viz, and I haven't had time with 11.5 yet. So, and I guess I'm seeing a shakes of heads and no's here in the room. So, no, there's been no test of the NSEP plugin from any of the PG partners.
All right. You'll be the first in
that. All right. I appreciate that. Thanks. Okay, moving right along here. I guess, yeah, this is kind of also along the lines is working with Raytheon to determine how the shader language works with the graphics card for displaying satellite imagery at greater than 8 bits, as well as compositing multiple images. I got to be honest, I'm not very familiar with how the shader language works at all. So, but this is something that's of importance to us, so we fully understand how image overlays work and anything that involves compositing in the alpha channel, I guess. Do you have anything to add, Raytheon?
Not really. There's a description in our previous response on that. No, I don't think we have any more to add to that at this time.
Okay. Where does the code to the graphics card actually reside? Where is that part of the code?
It's in files. I think they're called G. Let me look up the acronym. But GSLS or something like that. And there's a series of those in the baseline when you install the AEE. And they're in the static data part of the baseline. I can look that up real quick here. They're called GLSL files. And for example, They're in the, some of them are in the plug-in, like the ones for color map control and so on that the satellite would use is in the plug-in comradion.biz.core.gl.
Okay.
I mean, actually, what you can do is when Cave starts up, I believe you could change those files to experiment with them, you know, without a new build. To experiment with different algorithms. But, for example, the color map one is just, you know, about a page of code, and it's pretty simple. But it gets the min math and information, you know, passed into it. And then there's a couple different color advances. There's a linear advance, and then there's a log advance.
Okay. I think that'll be helpful. I'll try to spend a little more time looking at that before the next 10 minutes.
I think if you look in that section of the code, you can kind of see how that loaded and you know, how that worked.
Yeah, I agree. Where are we here? This one. I think this kind of plays back to some of the other action items we have in the specific questions, but the exact process in linking colors to value mappings and in defining the maximum and minimum for the displayed range. We previously asked things like, can more of this be defined in a configurable XML? Because really coming from AWIPS 1, when it came to configuring new data sets without really recompiling the software, all we had to do was use those flat text files, which kind of rough analog now is these XML files. And we kind of lost a bit of functionality there, although we do have the Python scripts as well that we can drop into the localization directories.
I can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was holding the mic just a little bit too far away. What we were looking at is discussing the process between linking colors to the value mappings and defining a max and min for the displayed range. And then we had previously asked, can more of this be defined in a configurable XML? And, you know, that's really, it's kind of a rhetorical question because what we'd really seen in AWIPS 1 was the configurable flat text files for which we could add new data sets to AWIPS 1. Didn't require the software to be recompiled. That is, it wasn't in the display end. It wasn't, you know, part of any kind of decoder. It was all just part of those flat text files. And the approximate analog to that is now the XML. And we also have some Python scripts which handle certain kinds of manipulations as well. Would you envision a big problem if we requested more of that kind of control to be held within an XML? For example, the legends, well, right now I think some of the things in XML include like the markers on the color bar, you know, what value equals 10, 20, 30, 40. There's display units, which you said I guess isn't used. The legend is like hard-coded and into some common code.
Yeah, I think you guys could write a TTR on what you wanted to have more under XML configuration control. That should be, I don't see any real problem with any of that.
I mean, was the only reason that some of the, like legends, for example, were hard-coded into the software is because it was just kind of one of the original decoders, and that's kind of been...
Yeah, that might be it. Yeah, actually, the satellite stuff was the very first data path through the system. And, you know, that was probably written 3 years ago or so,
okay.
4 years ago. And it probably didn't pick up all the configurability that's really, you know, necessary. So I think, you know, we don't have any TTRs on those points, but I think maybe that's because nobody's tried to change it.
Okay.
To write a DTR and the kind of configuration item you want, and I'm sure we can work a bit.
Yeah, I wrote a little white paper for NWS Alaska region, and I don't know if they want to proceed with some of the things I think might want to be reconsidered to be handled in XML or what. So we'll follow up with them, and I'd like to see a TTR move forward on this, but you know, I think the NWS should have some input on that as well.
I think some of the legend stuff is actually built from the metadata. Some aspect of it, but there probably could be more control over, you know, metadata to legend, you know, to human readable mapping done in an XML file.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess you're kind of pushing on right to our next one is what from the metadatabase is actually used for discovery and display. Has anybody gone through that and really determined what in that Postgres kind of ingest database is actually being used? I know we talked about the spatial objects, so I'm pretty clear on that. But
as a kind of a separate exercise, we've been going over some of the metadata, and somewhere or another, practically all that metadata gets used somewhere or another, and it becomes part of the satellite record when it's retrieved.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some pretty obscure metadata in there, things like the satellite subpoint, you know, like where I guess that's where the satellite is. Right over the Earth. And there's algorithms like in the fog processor that use that. So I found, you know, basically something somewhere that uses both all the metadata that's in the metadata right now.
Oh, okay. But we don't know what it is that uses what.
Well, you would have to, yeah, we would have to diagram it out or map it out. Like, for example, that fog thing is the only place I found that uses the subpoint.
Yeah, I did look at the fog processor just briefly a few weeks ago, and I did notice that there was a lot more in there than just the run-of-the-mill satellite product.
Yeah.
And that's because the fog processor is actually computing some kind of fog. I guess it's like a probability or fog map. So there's actually some science involved with that code. So I think that is a little interesting to figure out how that works, because we have some more complex products that may be like that or a functionality we may want to use. Okay, that's good. We were going to save anything on a sample project for a face-to-face TIM, and I think the remaining things here were talk about image blending and the capabilities of the graphics card. We kind of already covered that briefly. Do you have anything else to say or anything that might have changed with how image blending is done?
Yeah, that's an interesting topic. And I can just... you know, off the top of my head, there's one comment I can make about it, and this has to do with the way the Air Force has done it. They've established like a worldwide database, using a relational database actually for the metadata, and they tile the data. So that there's a tile for every spot on the world. This is for polar orbiting data. And then the different passes get filled in the different tiles as they go by, and it's then converted to map space. You know, tiles are in map.
Does the Air Force have this software?
Yeah. So it's a program that's been in existence for a long time. It was one of our original projects in Omaha back in the middle 90s to do that, that database. And it deals with multiple satellite types and channels and all that. We have a satellite expert in house that designed it. He's still here. But basically, he was very concerned that you could deal with multiple passes of data and very conveniently from a display point of view. So then, I guess what it means is on a display where you could retrieve tiles and you don't really care too much about where they came from. The NGS software takes care of it.
Okay.
I don't know if that's the best approach for the future, though.
But I mean, I could see something where we could bring in like a geostationary satellite and maybe tile that and then tile polar on top of it.
Yeah, actually, I've been thinking about this a little bit. I kind of think if we could do some of this in the graphics card so that you could mix and match satellites without having to do all this pre-processing on the server side. You could do that dynamically. I think that would be a lot better, a more modern approach. But I think it would take a bit of engineering to figure out.
Okay. Is that something we might be able to look at in a face-to-face, Tim?
Yeah, I might be able to get our satellite expert. You know, he's like older than I am. He's like in his 60s. Involved in the discussion.
Okay. I guess the last action item for status was kind of an end-to-end of the satellite decoder and how that works. I've kind of gone through that, and I guess what we're trending toward, and Brian Mott and others have had some suggestions on this, is really trying to develop a document, kind of a first look document for people that are part of this PG TIM process and those that aren't, about how we go from kind of first principles, starting with a new satellite data set and then working its way through the system. Sorry. So, has there been any work on development of such a document?
Yeah. Actually, Doug and I are in the process of putting together what we call a software design document that we're going to orientate towards developers and what they need to know about the architecture. To understand, you know, how to extend it and make changes to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few principles, high-level principles that aren't obvious, as I tell from the questions I get, that once you understand that it falls into place, that it's not as daunting as it first sounds. But there's a separation. I think the problem a lot of people are having is you see something like a satellite decoder, you think, well, how the heck does that get invoked? Well, you're not going to find it by looking in the code, because
mm-hmm.
it's controlled by the wiring, you know, in the ESP. So there's parts of the system that are controlled by the ESP, and then parts of it that are just traditional code hierarchy. The plug-in, are very much wired together through DSP, so it's useful to look at the XML files that go with the plugin, because that'll tell you exactly how things are sequenced and where their inputs come from and where their outputs go. It's very
Okay, I appreciate that.
Once that's understood, then a lot of questions kind of fall into place, yes. Or answers fall into place.
Ask Frank if that's in the document that Ed promised us in August.
The other thing that's probably a little daunting for people is about multi-threading that's going on, especially in caves.
Mm-hmm.
And how things are done with listeners and indirect references. It's very heavy-duty OO, I would say. but it requires, a fair amount of deep OO understanding to follow some of what goes on in caves.
Okay.
And we did all these things for very specific purposes, the multi-threading, of course, is for performance, so that the screen never locks up, so that any interaction you do with the screen spreads off, like data retrieval, and so on, tiling, loading things into the display. All those things are multi-threaded. And threads then are generic, so you don't find a thread for satellite, a thread for this, and a thread for that. But that requires an understanding of how the listers work and the OO hierarchy, and the interfaces in the OO hierarchy. I mean, once that's understood, everything kind of just crystallizes, I think, for people.
Okay.
But we need to make it easier through documentation to make that jump.
Yep. Thank you. We would appreciate that. And that kind of concludes the end of our action items. I'm going to turn it back over to Bill.
Yeah. The room's starting to fill back up again. We're reconvening in less than 5 minutes. So before we call it quits here for today, we wanted to talk just briefly about a way ahead for the face-to-face gym. And Dr. Franklin likes to suggest a date of 17 and 18 August.
I missed what the meeting was.
It's the face-to-face TIM at the Omaha facility, where we really, and we're envisioning like 10 to 12 folks, two from Sims, two from Sierra, two from Sporting, maybe a few other folks, to sit down and go through some code development to deal with ingest and display in the AWIFS 2 environment. So I don't know if you can say if that date, 17 and 18 August, is good for you right now.
It's far enough out there that I can't think of anything that would conflict with it.
No, that's fine, Frank. But I think we need to take it off and work with it from the other side, make sure that the other people are lined up with it.
Right, exactly. And the other, in order to make this a truly effective two-day face-to-face meeting, we need to lay out a very clear agenda. Now, and those questions that I sent to you that Jordan had put together would be part of that. And any suggestions that you have, we need to have a small group that kind of works on what that agenda would be. So your input would be critical to that.
Yeah, Frank's already started answering those questions.
That's good.
Well, I have some written response that basically a short paragraph for each one. I could probably have that done by the end of the day or so, or tomorrow, that I could send out.
Okay, that'd be great. What we want to be able to accomplish, though, is have folks actually sitting there working with you.
I understand what you want, Bill, but let's take it offline. If you don't mind, I understand exactly what you want, but I can't commit to it today.
Okay, another question. When you
helpful for those of us attending to know what we should bring to the table, you know, just have a set of guidelines for how prepared we should come so that we can make the most out of your time.
Okay.
Yep. I agree offline because we need to reconvene here.
Hey, Bill, this is Kevin McGrath from Sport. If I could just take 10 seconds to say a wish list that we would have is if we could get like a handheld walkthrough, be it a couple hours of developing a couple simple plugins, an edX plugin and a Viz plugin, something simple, of bringing in an SCDF file or maybe an ASCII tab delimited file, something just to work us through the basic plugin development. I think that would answer a lot of our questions.
Yep, that's the kind of thing we're looking for.
Yep, that's possible.
Okay, we're going to close this out. Doug and Frank, thanks very much. And Jordan has the action to write up the notes from this meeting. And he'll get those out whenever his schedule allows, but he's pretty good about getting them out. And so I'll close the meeting, and thanks everyone for your participation.